So there's just stories like that. But that's not what I want to pick your brain about. Uh-huh. But okay. You come highly recommended.
Oh, all right.
So the governor asked me to write this in 2013, mm-hmm. and I was able to interview him four times before he died.
Okay.
Then I also, there's like 1,900 pages of oral history
okay.
from the early 1990s.
Okay.
And it's pretty clear, I've written the big chapter on 1982 to about 1985 with the sales tax,
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff, and it's really clear that he had set ideas about what kinds of taxes were most equitable,
mm-hmm.
what kind of taxes would be most saleable to the electorate, those kinds of things. And the reality of things gets interesting because he didn't like the sales tax because he called it a hidden tax because people at the end of the year don't add up what it is.
Right, but
literature, however, says that's exactly also, the opposite
yeah,
way.
Yeah,
but
he also didn't like it because he was a retailer.
Ah, okay.
Because his business, his father and his uncle created,
yeah.
and that he and his brother were running, was a retail business, selling rugs at the retail market.
Yeah.
And he understood the retailer.
Do you think it was that he saw it as another imposition on the retailer, or that it would change the price structure? I mean, he was about small government and government staying out of our lives.
Yeah,
so.
He didn't articulate it that way. One of the things that was great, I thought, about Atiyah was that, one, you have to realize that all his legislative career, he was on the Revenue Committee,
yeah.
either in the House or the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And all for a significant amount of that, I was not the legislative revenue office. I created that, but I was in the old tax commission doing research, and so I was mm-hmm. sitting with the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had a question about the sales tax or any other tax,
right.
I would answer it. So I watched him for many years
yeah.
on the committee. And his articulation, and one of the great things that I always thought about him, A, he read a bill.
Yes.
And I've always been amazed that the legislature creates a written document, a law,
mm-hmm.
and yet very few of the people there actually read what
right.
they're passing.
Yeah.
He would read the bill, and he would actually, on a big bill like the sales tax, he would get out his little pen knife, and he'd cut the bill so the pages easily flowed,
mm-hmm.
and he wasn't chair
right.
of the committee, he was just a member, and he'd say, chair, let's go through this sales tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
He would state up front, I'm not in favor of it, but I want to make it the best bill I can that will
right.
get out there.
Right.
So I thought that was a great intellectual process that he would go through.
Mm-hmm.
He would do that on other tax issues, say, and let the committee know way up front before you got anywhere close to a vote.
Right.
No, I'm not in favor of that.
Yeah.
But let's work on this bill and see what we can do.
Yeah.
Because he would sense it's going to pass.
Right.
And if it's going to pass, let's be sure we've cleaned up any problems in it.
Yeah. So when did you first start working for the legislature?
1964.
64, okay. Because 63 is when he's carrying Hatfield's taxes.
Yeah, and Hatfield had a really weird... He wanted a second income tax. And that's just a gross income
right.
tax on top of the current income tax.
Right. So I want to get your explanation for what that was. Because there's the net receipts tax, there's the gross receipts tax. Sometimes they look more sales taxy, sometimes they look more income taxy.
Mm-hmm.
So...
No, Hatfield proposed, in effect, a gross income tax,
mm-hmm.
I would say,
mm-hmm.
and it for individuals, you would take your total gross income calculate against a rate before you dealt, or you weren't allowed to deal with any deductions.
Right.
Now, the rates were different then, mm-hmm. the brackets were different then, and but this is only my subjective opinion,
mm-hmm.
I always thought that he proposed this not in a serious vein, that he didn't, it was an alternative of which, you can't have a sales tax, everybody's defeated that, I don't want to take the income tax and increase it. I can't deal with a property tax at the state level. Therefore, I'm going to propose the second income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, most legislators, dismissed it rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That it just wasn't viable to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the evolution, though, then of into the McCall era, mm-hmm. and now McCall is again wants to create changes in the tax system, and his first big run on it was the sales tax again,
mm-hmm.
and then that was shattered again,
mm-hmm.
and then his next big run in 73 was an income tax driven property tax relief program school finance system,
right.
And that was very, well, as far as the history of tax programs, that one came the closest.
Right.
But Attia and McCall were miles apart.
Yeah. So I'm just spending time in 73 right now in the research, and Vic eventually is one of the three senators that changes their votes to send it to the floor, and Vic says, I think it's a bad idea,
yes.
but the people ought to be able to have a say on this.
Right, but then he took the lead in opposing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have big television debates on it with the governor, mm-hmm. McCall there, Attia is there opposing it.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one, and so McCall, as a result, McCall would never endorse Attia.
Yeah.
It was a direct quid pro quo,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, well, and shortly after this, I haven't pegged down the exact date, McCall and Attia were two people who went back to Washington, D.C. to testify about land use.
Mm.
And on that trip, McCall said to Attia, I've never really liked you. And I found out McCall actually went over to Attia's house between 59 and 62-ish. He'd occasionally come over for dinner.
Mm.
People really say that 73 fight over taxes when McCall just...
Yes, he just froze him out.
Yeah. So, there was also a cigarette tax that Hatfield was trying to get through, and Oregon didn't have a cigarette tax.
No, we were one of two or three states without a cigarette tax.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah.
And then it was put up as a 4 cent cigarette tax, and I think a penny was going to something like cities, and a penny to counties, and 4 cents to a funny little property tax relief program.
Right.
And then that passed.
Yeah.
And then that started growing, and it's grown ever since.
Yeah.
It's a sin tax, and so it's easy.
Sin tax of the voters' life.
Yeah.
Exactly. Talk to me about this concept of property tax relief.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any serious attempts to really reform the property tax system? Because what I see is everybody fights should it be a 6% limit, should be a 1.5% limit, but then that never comes together, and they say, okay, so what we need is property tax relief for X, Y, or Z.
Well, you've got this evolution. You come out of World War II. And the property tax system in the 30s and 40s was a shambles.
Mm-hmm.
In effect, huge variation across the state what people were doing. Mills not on the roll in this county, on the roll in that county.
Mm-hmm.
So the legislature created, in effect, a massive program that the old tax commission ran, which was to go county by county and reappraise every piece of property.
Oh.
And as they did that, then you had these groups come to the legislature saying, oh, you know, that's market value for that property. We can't do that. We can't sustain that. So then you see through the 50s and into the early 60s a series of exemptions for different classes of property,
right,
which then shifts the value to the homeowner,
yeah,
and the small business is, yeah, what it fundamentally, yeah, did. So then you start seeing cries in the 60s of, oh my God, my property taxes are going up. How could that be?
Yeah.
And then you see the legislatures trying to say, okay, well, let's see about giving property tax relief to the homeowners or,
yeah,
or somebody else here. And so you, before that, there was concern over the property tax, but it wasn't like the Howells that started once. You had an initiative on the 1.5% come, mm-hmm, forward.
Mm-hmm.
So don't confuse property tax limits like the 1.5% versus the 6%. The 6% is the automatic increase of a levy that has been voter approved.
Okay.
So okay. It's a different.
Okay.
It doesn't mean your taxes go up 6%. It might, right, mean yours go up less or more.
Right.
Yeah. So then you had a whole series of things on the limit. You first had the first property tax limit that was headed for the ballot. Gildermeister, I think, was the chief sponsor. And the Supreme Court took it off the ballot. And they took it off the ballot for a very different reason. It hadn't been certified by the Secretary of State's office in time.
Mm-hmm.
Then they came right back with another property tax limit, the next for 69,
mm-hmm,
and that came fairly close. There was real concern. But now, because of those initiatives, then the legislature, well, we can't, if you limit property, the cut is going to be too big. What can we do?
Right.
So now you start having them scrambling around for what they could do. And they initially obviously tried restructuring the tax system, like,
right,
the sales tax of 69, or then eventually the McCall's program of 73. But you also had them trying to provide direct relief to lower income people,
mm-hmm,
and that was the HARP program.
Yeah.
And so that evolved in trying to maybe address it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you still had the pressure of trying to provide exemptions at times.
Right.
AOI was definitely opposed to anything that would provide the homeowner relief and not them relief.
Mm-hmm.
So the homestead exemption got kicked around, but yeah, never went anywhere. And of course, ATIA all the way through that is part of that.
Yeah.
But you see, some of Atiyah's views on taxes changed when he became governor.
Yeah, I'm getting a sense of that, just as I've done this big tax thing from 82 to 85,
mm-hmm,
but the way he thinks about things is different than the evolution of him as I'm going through the legislature.
Yes.
So what did you see as some of the major change when he's sitting in the executive suite?
Yeah, well, somewhat. When he ran for governor, you had the 1.5% on,
right,
the ballot.
Yeah.
And now he's trying, Straub is running against him and trying to go for a second term.
Mm-hmm.
And Straub doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I had several calls from that office. Doesn't know what to do. He didn't like the limit. And historically, ATIA had opposed a property tax limit.
Yeah.
So he ran sort of saying, look, at that one's bad, but if I'm elected, I'll do a better one.
Mm-hmm.
So then he is elected, and now he proposes to the legislature a sort of 1.5% limit on more on residential property than anything else. And that in it by itself is somewhat a change from where he's been.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the limit, the idea of on more on residential property.
Mm-hmm.
when I was legislative revenue officer then, when we did the analysis on it, present it to the committee, the House committee, you had virtually every Republican on the House committee. They didn't like it at all. It is very strange to watch, to be in the legislature, and then to be go see the governor at times. You would be called in the governor's office, you'd go up. And sometimes you'd be there, and a legislator, well, he had called once in, and he maybe wanted me in the office with him in case some tax question came up. And it was amazing to be sitting outside. Now, you have to realize my position, I knew all the legislators, and they knew me. So I'm sitting outside his office, and I'm talking to, in this case, in my mind, Tony Meeker. And Tony is saying, God, the governor is just absolutely stupid on this. He's just terrible on this. I don't know what's happened. For God, I can't say. And then you go into his office, and now, you know, Tony's very dignified, very nice to the governor, everything, and the governor's trying to actually get him to vote for a bill that he wants, and Tony is not telling him directly anything.
Yeah.
He's not saying no, he's not saying yes, and at this time, Tony was the majority leader.
He's become the minority leader
in the Senate.
Yeah, the minority leader, yeah.
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 So it was always interesting to me to see the difference from outside his office to inside his office, what information you get.
Yeah.
The only information I think Atiyah ever got out of that meeting was, I guess I better watch the Senate and see what happens on the vote.
Yeah.
So, because I think Kitzhaber was Senate president at the time, and the bill, Kitzhaber was saying he needed so many Republican votes to do it. And that's what he told the governor.
Yeah.
And Atiyah was trying to get those votes.
Yeah.
But it's a strange process politically to sit outside. Yeah. And I was in a unique position, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I'm discovering that in looking at history of Vic in the legislature, because there are so many things. Like, he was in the middle of the formation of our environmental laws. He was on the side of the bottle bill, and really extraneous to the beach bill, but he lived with it. But everybody I talked to, Democrats and Republicans, talk about how Tom McCall had nothing to do with it until X, Y, or Z. And in all the McCall stuff, because I've been reading all sorts of things, it's like the legislature doesn't exist. And so my book is going to basically give the legislative side of a lot of this. I don't know how people will take that or not, but but it's Vic then gets to live that. Do you think he was paying attention to the difference between being a legislator? You know, because he used to be one of the guys sitting outside the office.
Yeah,
waiting to go in to see Straub or McCall, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I see. In my experience over this period, I see you can be a governor and, in a sense, a role of seeing in your head a role of a governor as a super legislator.
Okay.
So you're not the Senate president, you're not the speaker, you're somebody above that.
Right.
But you're a super legislator.
Right.
Or you can see yourself in as a governor. Of being a leader of Oregon, a much bigger role.
Right.
And I would say that's what McCall tended to see.
Yeah.
He was able to fill that role in some way. He when meetings I was in and McCall had legislators in, he was berating them. He had no respect for them. Davis, his chief of staff, had to, you know, okay, Governor, you got that meeting going. You better get that speech, and Eugene, you better get going. And then Davis would deal with it. Davis would very effectively deal with the legislature, appointing them, do different things, and get their vote. And it wasn't McCall getting their vote,
right?
Because he didn't respect them.
Yeah.
But he had this aura of what he could do with the public and the public support.
Mm-hmm.
And I never saw Atiyah actually grow in that way.
Uh-huh.
But it was a different era, too. I mean, you had the big recession.
Yeah.
And so you had a lot of unemployment.
You're in the trenches.
Yeah, and he saw a role then of, I've got to do economic development. I got to try to bring in international companies.
Yeah.
He saw that more a role of him being governor.
Yeah.
But as dealing with the legislature and that part of the role, he played it more like a super legislature.
Mm-hmm.
He, in a sense, since he had spent so long in the legislature, he respected it so much, the institution.
Right. Right.
He couldn't get out like McCall did and criticize it and
right.
tell them they're idiots.
Yeah.
But McCall could easily do that.
Yeah. Now, were you around when Goldschmidt was there doing this kind of
yes.
thing?
Yes.
So Goldschmidt, like McCall, doesn't have an experience with the legislature.
Right.
His big thing was getting to 5 votes
mm-hmm.
or making sure that Jimmy Carter's transportation stuff worked. So did you see a similar type thing when Goldschmidt was in there?
Yes. I didn't see it similar to the super legislature.
Right, but
it was similar to McCall in mm-hmm. the sense, except Neil was sort of a combination of Davis and McCall. He would deal with individual legislators and buddy them up and
yeah.
do good things and get them,
yeah.
get Thorne as a conservative Democrat to do what he wanted. So he was very good at being buddy-buddy with individual legislators
mm-hmm.
To pull their vote, but then also had a bigger vision of what to do.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you leave the legislative office and start working for the governor?
I think it was 84.
Mm-hmm.
So I came into and created the legislative government office in 74. And then 84 became director of the Department of Revenue. But I saw that role more as not an administrator of taxes, but more as a fiscal policy advisor to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way
mm-hmm.
he saw it.
Yeah.
So whenever there was any kind of tax issue, I was in his office and would talk it through or work it. That's the way it, and I think that fits Oregon more. We're a smaller state. In California, you would have a fiscal policy advisor in the governor's office.
Right.
You wouldn't have a dual role for that person.
Right.
So, and Oregon is gradually evolving that way because the governor's staff's expanding quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about all the different responses as the recessions hit. So 79 has been described to me as kind of the high watermark of revenue coming in. And what does the legislature do? They basically give away a whole bunch back to the taxpayers, and we put the kicker in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go away, and by September, Paul Volcker is saying interest rates are too low,
mm-hmm.
and by December they've risen like 40%. Mm-hmm. So we're into crisis mode.
Right.
And crisis mode big in 80. A little bit of a down, and then 82, the wheels come off.
Right.
So,
see, let's come back to the politics. In in 78, again, you have a Tia running, and like 1.5%,
yeah.
running. Don't vote for that. I'll create something new. So when he came in and created his budget, he had to put forth something.
Right.
He did have. What would appear from the forecast a abundance of money
mm-hmm.
because employment was very high at that point. Economics were very good in 78 and 70, what appeared to be good in 79. So he had a rather typical budget plus this extra money that all went for property tax relief.
Mm-hmm.
He then... as I said earlier, I was in the legislative revenue office. We did an analysis of it, presented it to the committee. The Republicans on the committee didn't like it. The
mm-hmm.
Democrats, the committee didn't like it. But then they took that money, that same money, and tried to create their own program. and that was the 30% property tax relief. Mm-hmm. There was a expenditure limitation. There was income tax relief. There was, as you said, the kicker in it. That got added in the Senate side. Mm-hmm. And now that goes ultimately to a conference committee. Conference committee approves it. It goes to the governor. The governor actually doesn't sign it.
Mm-hmm.
He lets it go into effect without a signature. Then, and by the way, then you had the forecaster, Paul, was Ager was there as the forecaster in the executive department before the House and Senate committees explaining his forecast, and his forecast was bright.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the money was mm-hmm. in the forecast.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have, after Sine die, you have maybe 5-6 weeks, and now Ager comes back with a forecast which is dramatically reduced.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then the legislature, now you go through a series of crises, because the legislature comes to a series of special sessions cutting the tax program they just created,
mm-hmm.
the property tax relief of the program, not the income tax relief,
mm-hmm.
only the property tax relief mm-hmm. of that program they cut to help balance the budget. And then TIA also had to propose for each of the special sessions how to balance the budget.
Mm-hmm.
He proposed first speed ups of tax collection.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a pay speed up of withholding.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think the next time, now I don't remember.
Would you have been conscious of where he got that idea?
Oh, I predicted it to the Speaker and Senate President. That okay. would be his proposal.
Okay. I'm just wondering, because Victor had just taken over the family business when the income tax changed from being something that you paid the next year in mm-hmm. quarterly payments
mm-hmm.
to you paid it that year
mm-hmm.
as withholding.
Yeah.
And so he had lived through, in effect, yes. a speed-up.
Right.
So.
Well, I think the idea that was maybe more current was the idea the federal government had recently done the same
okay.
thing.
Okay.
And so what we were doing is moving from the schedule that we didn't adopt the federal to more adopting the federal
right.
schedule.
Right.
So it wasn't a big burden from the standpoint of just the administration of it
mm-hmm.
To speed it up.
Mm-hmm.
So then you had, I think, 3 special sessions, and each one dealt with a tax increase, expenditure cut, property tax cut, property tax relief
mm-hmm.
cut.
Mm-hmm.
And he proposed different things in each of them, of which the easiest was a speed up.
Mm-hmm.
When he got to the end of that, he tried to propose again, I think, I'm just going from memory,
mm-hmm.
so,
mm-hmm.
somewhat like the Hatfield income double income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the legislature couldn't deal with that at all.
Yeah.
The Democrats that were in the legislature
yeah.
couldn't deal with
yeah.
that. So. They then went off on their own to balance the budget
mm-hmm.
that with the revenue side
mm-hmm.
of it. And I don't remember right now what they actually did. Income tax something on it. But anyway.
Yeah. It's wild.
That was very tough times
mm-hmm.
economically
mm-hmm.
and very tough. He couldn't get, so he's elected. His first session is a big thing, and
mm-hmm.
it's, and then they end up rejecting his plan, doing, and then you go bam, bam, bam in these special sessions, and now, you know, he's been hit right and left, and most of the time is spent, right there in
mm-hmm.
the building.
Yeah.
So he's not able to get a bigger vision, to me.
Yeah.
Get out and do stuff and talk to the people and find out what's, because everything that's a problem right now is the recession, people
yeah.
unemployed.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? How much is this transition and the lumber and wood products
yeah.
That's occurring rapidly, but how far is it going to go? Is it going
right.
to stop someplace here?
Right.
So I think he's caught up in that and caught up in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes him a while to get his feet out of the building and start thinking about economic development, what he can do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's when he starts traveling abroad, going to China. And to,
Jerry Thompson talks about really pushing him to begin to think like that.
Yes.
But that's 81 is when she comes in. So there's been 2 years...
Yes.
Of him
just being stuck there because of the budget problems.
Yeah. Role for Lee Johnson in all this?
I hope this is he's dead now, so
don't worry, lots of people said lots of things about Lee Johnson.
he seemed like a disaster as the chief of staff, because that's he seemed to be more like I'm the governor.
Yeah.
And he's running around doing things and trying to make deals, and it would appear that he never talked to Vic about it.
Yeah. I've got from several people who were in the meetings with Vic and Lee Johnson, Lee Johnson saying, but Governor, you have to do this because if you don't, my credibility is shot.
Yeah.
Like, no. And the governor apparently said, I'm willing to go talk to people and say there was a miscommunication, mm-hmm. but no, this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was never in a meeting when he did that, but mm-hmm. that I wouldn't be in that because
you were on the legislative side at that point. Yeah.
But I was in a lot of meetings where Lee Johnson maybe was trying to deal with the Speaker or Senate President, and as if he was governor.
Yeah,
and that was just crazy to me. So when Jerry came in, everything smoothed out to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
She was great. She was really a very effective. Very competent in what she did,
mm-hmm.
and was very a real compliment to Atiyah to mm-hmm. be there. I mean, that just their partnership worked real well.
As you are working in the legislative side and then you go work for the governor's side, did you see Victor begin to kind of rise up out of the building and be more Tom McCullish looking at things, or was he always kind of the super legislator?
I think he never gained that full stature of, to me, of being, of seeing himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not being, it's more or less how you view yourself and how you view that role.
Yeah.
And I still think he had so many years of working in the legislature that he was ground there that and respected that so much. Where he needed to be able to, regardless, to step back and criticize it when needed.
Right.
And as far as I know, that never happened.
Yeah. He had criticized stances, but he didn't criticize the institution or...
No. Or individuals.
That. Yeah.
Why can't they... So, I mean, I think in politics you do need to be able to step back from that and see. Because the institution or committee gets to be very narrow mm-hmm. at times.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a broader view at times of what are they doing? Why are they doing that? That seems silly. It's mm-hmm. not what the public, it's not in the public interest to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a better idea.
Yeah. Yeah. As the Rajneeshis came along, did you see that? I mean, because Victor, one thing I've discovered in doing this book is the governor does a heck of a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like you're in this doing this, boom, 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 and then you're doing this for 20 minutes, and then you're doing this for an hour. And
or less.
Yeah, or less, exactly. Did you see the Rajneeshis cast a pall over things, or was that compartmentalized for the governor?
To be honest, I don't have any clear memory of anything that Vic was doing around it other than what generally was in the building of a broad... general concern, what's happening here.
Yeah.
I have a clearer picture of Norma Paulus being more critical of what was going on than I have of anybody else.
Okay. Well, when you read the chapter, you'll learn a lot of things. Okay, that's good. That's good. As Victor gets towards the end of his second term, he's traveling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, the way he described it is, he had kind of three things he wanted to do to make Oregon a better place for development.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing is changing the attitude of visit, don't stay.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is make sure that the land use is put in place firmly. So all the counties have got plans, all mm-hmm. the cities have got plans, because that hadn't come through yet. And then the third thing is going in, just being a salesman and talking to companies and,
right.
you know, doing things. So
right.
repealing the unitary tax
yes.
method is part of that. It's the first chapter I wrote, actually,
because mm-hmm.
It's discreet. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. All these other things bleed into everything else. so by the time you come on, we're into that kind mm-hmm. of thinking
right.
and doing that. So what does that do in terms of thinking about revenue issues? Is tax reform still a major part of all this, or are we really focusing on the getting companies in?
He's not heavily into tax reform at that time.
Okay.
I have to step over
yeah.
to the bathroom.
Okay,
right
no problem.
There.
I shall pause.
Okay, please.
Political analyst.
Uh-huh.
And so I've run into Victor off and on since about 2000. But he decided to give all his papers and
yes.
everything to Pacific.
Right.
And so I started working with him then, and mm-hmm. he what likes my political analysis, and, you know, said, you call it like you see it. Because the deal on this book is it's not about Victor, it's about the times and a guy, Victor, who was in there.
Where did you do your graduate work?
Northwestern University.
Uh-huh.
And then I grew up in Southern Oregon.
Well,
so
a wee lad down there, and you went all the way to Northwestern?
Well, I went to Stanford, I went to Monterey. I never thought I'd live in Oregon again, and then I re-met someone from my high school class just before our 10-year reunion, and yeah. she lived here.
Did you know the Frohnmeyer family when you were a wee
my
lad?
My parents were very good friends with them. Dave Frohnmeyer was actually the babysitter to my first serious girlfriend.
Did you know Dunbar Carpenter?
Yeah.
The Carpenter family?
Yeah, New Carpenter. We used to go to Glenn Jackson's house and go swimming in the pool. So, yeah, all those things. John Dellenbach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wear bow ties because of John Dellenbach. His wife, Mary Jane, just died.
Oh.
All those people.
Dunbar and I went down to Colorado together here a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
Rode to Colorado for 18 days.
Uh-huh.
And had a good time together.
That's great.
He was a legislator staff member in the early 70s.
Hmm.
Jason Bowe
mm-hmm.
apparently hired him before he went to... Before he went to law school, and then he went to law school, and then he went to Switzerland and became a young psychologist.
Hmm.
That's why he practices in Portland.
Yeah.
Now.
Huh?
Amazing.
Yeah, all those things, all those people. So we were talking about Victor. You were saying that when you came in, Victor really wasn't doing tax reform. It was recruiting businesses coming in and things like that.
Yeah. He did still, every session you still have tax stuff going on.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, after he got there a while, the unitary issue came up.
Mm-hmm.
Business was all over it. It was in California, and Oregon was actually one of the leading states in developing the idea around the unitary tax.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always court-driven. So it was tax commission doing something, the corporation appealing it to the tax court affirming what the commission did.
Mm.
And that evolved into the unitary system.
Mm-hmm.
And then Attias sitting on the committee in the Senate during all that period. And so the revenue department or tax commission would come in and explain, here's what went on in that tax case,
mm-hmm.
and here's the way it's being treated. So he knew the unitary issue well,
mm-hmm.
actually,
mm-hmm.
But I think Attia, as a political animal, understood the huge amount of concern among business, particularly international businesses.
Yeah, it the Japanese were not pulling any punches.
No. In fact, I was in meetings with some Japanese companies in my office, and they wanted to explain exactly how their business worked, because they were sure if you know exactly how their business worked, you would not apply unitary to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a big chalkboard. I had the corporate people in there had four or five of their people, and we went over, okay, let's see, what do you do? How does the business work between here and your head office in Japan over this issue, finance? Are you able to deal with? They would go to the board and write out, no, we have to get approval from here. And then we would say, okay, that means that you're dealing with unitary. Then you'd go to the next issue. Oh, and they would just openly tell us, oh, okay, that means, went down the list, and they became so frustrated that they actually had to quit talking and go to, I don't know, some book that they had with them on Japanese and just sit there for a while to try to calm down. And they were complete, and no matter intellectually, they still didn't understand what was happening, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's what, when Atiyah proposed the change, I was to carry it, went to the committee, and I tried to explain that meeting to the committee.
Yeah.
And that meeting to the committee, they understood how it just didn't connect with foreign corporations, that somehow this was a legitimate or fair method.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Now, we're a long way from that now, by the way.
Oh, I know, but it's interesting with all the stuff about where people are hiding money and that stuff. It's like, you know, there's a flavor of the unitary to it.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, and so where's our biggest tax loophole here in this country? It's North Dakota. Like, okay, there you go.
So you have him dealing with unitary. You still have the concern of level of support for schools. That's the big driver still on property tax relief of some form. And you still have the schools coming to Atiyah and trying to get some additional funding, but more for, can we put together a program?
Yeah.
Can we do something with a program here? Some kind of package. We refer to the voters. And that was driven greatly by the... I would say by the lobby, but he understood the lobby working in the legislature. They had come to him on lots of other things.
Yeah.
So he knew how to deal with them effectively.
Yeah.
And he is, I presume he's less attentive at this point to tax issues or some grandiose issue, some grandiose plan. And that's, and McCall didn't want to ever let go of that.
Yeah.
It wasn't solved, so he wouldn't let go. So, okay, if this doesn't work, we're going to go here.
Yeah.
If that doesn't work, we're going to go here.
Yeah.
He just hung in there where that, once that alternative to his property tax limit that was on the ballot, once that didn't work, he dried up a lot on big tax issues, on how do you reform the whole system.
Yeah.
How do you look at that and see it? But he had sat on the committee for all the 20 years or more and seen all these other plans come through.
Right.
All of them go to the voters and be defeated. Because I used to sit with I would rehearse for the committee here. Let's look at, before you develop the next plan, let's just have a run through of the history. Okay, that was it. That one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then right after Atiyah's sales tax goes down by the usual amount, the OEA comes up with theirs that they've been working on anyway, and the next year it goes down by the, almost exactly the same numbers.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And that was unusual for somehow Atiyah, after all those years of opposing a sales tax,
though, yeah,
to now come up with a sales tax.
Now, do you think...
I would say that's a difference in being in the committee and being governor and the forces around the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the business community wanted a sales tax. Still do.
Yeah.
That's what they see as the modification. And they see it as, oh, we get a sales tax, we cut income taxes, we're happy.
Yeah.
And yet, it's sort of like a sales tax, those words mean different things to different people.
Yeah. And he tried, in that campaign, he tried to make the case that it meant your income tax and property taxes will be lower.
Yes. But,
and
but,
that worked just as well as every other time.
I think my own theory is that tax trading doesn't work.
Yeah.
That it automatically creates enough negatives that it can't work.
Right.
Because I don't want the income tax cut. I don't pay much in income taxes. So why do I want a sales tax?
Yeah. And in that 83-ish time, it was even more extreme because the legislature had passed education reform,
mm-hmm,
if the sales tax passed.
Yes.
So there's all this conditional.
Right.
It's really complex.
Well, and they always get in this pocket of trying to think, well, if we guarantee that in the Constitution, but that isn't even the issue.
Mm-mm.
The public, oh, sales tax? I can't get much beyond that.
Yeah. In right after Atiyah is reelected in 82, he proposes a gross receipts tax.
Mm-hmm.
The gross receipts is like 85% individuals and 15% companies, or you know, something along those lines. Fascinating to me that it raises, in today's dollars, $1.5 billion,
mm-hmm,
which is in the same general range as the gross receipts tax,
mm-hmm,
they're doing now. But this gross receipts tax now will be basically just on business,
right,
whereas his was going to be spread.
Yes.
So is that, in your mind, is that gross receipts just a double income tax?
Yes.
Okay.
And if you went back and looked at Hatfield's, mm-hmm, proposal in the 60s, you would find it's very similar.
Okay. That's my sense.
And he was sitting on the committee,
yeah,
then, and Hatfield's staff was explaining it. He, yeah, knew that.
Yeah.
And now, and he knew it went nowhere.
Yeah.
He knew in 62 or earlier that it didn't get anybody on the committee, and not even him.
Right.
And now he proposes it again.
Yeah.
So either, I actually don't know why he did that, unless he was just in such a box, personally.
Well, he says in the early 90s in his oral history, he says he found it to be the most equitable tax. Of all the taxes, because he, you know, after being on the committee 3 or 4 years, you figure out there are only so many taxes and so many people you can tax.
Yes, right.
You know, so it's A to B, A to C, A to B, there we go, that's it.
Yes.
And there was something about the gross receipts and the net receipts that he found to be, you know, in effect, fairer in the way that it hit society as a whole, for the taxpayers as a whole.
Yeah, I'm not sure that mm-hmm. I mean, I trust that's what he said.
Oh, yeah. And this is just, you know, like as we started out this conversation, he had very set ways on understanding taxes, mm-hmm, which don't really match the way many other people think about taxes.
Right. My own view might be that he was in a box where he needed to propose something.
Mm-hmm.
He, at that point, was not in favor, still did not want to propose a sales tax, did not want to propose an increase in the income tax, and this is somewhat a backdoor increase in the income tax, is what it is.
Yeah.
And he knows it didn't go anyplace.
Mm-hmm.
I think he knew that the Democrats in the legislature wouldn't buy it at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's throw it at them, let them say no, and let them come up with their own program.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally what they did.
Yeah.
So that's in a sense what I thought Hatfield did in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He threw it out knowing it wasn't an idea that was going to float.
Yeah.
But to a certain extent, he's off the hook.
Right. Because it's floating, it's going with them.
Yeah.
Hatfield also doing it with the net receipts and cigarettes is 10% of his budget.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a gimme and we can cut it, which is what they ended up having mm-hmm. to do. If right. it doesn't fly, we can cut it.
Right.
Atiyah was thinking bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, still same kind of thing.
Yeah. And then later, near the end, I was in meetings with him in the school group. And now in the school group, he was proposing, okay, I'm willing to do A, B, and C in the income tax and generate a lot more money. And would you like to go initiative on it? And I'll support it.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the end, near the very end of his term.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like, I view myself leaving politics here, and I want to do right. I've always appreciated schools, mm-hmm. always appreciated you people. Now, and it was too liberal a program yeah. by far.
Yeah.
And they were taken back. Ozzie and Chris Dudley and Danielson, mm-hmm. oh my God, the governor's willing to go more than we could go at mm-hmm. times.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really trying, to a certain extent, trying to smooth things with them, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great counterfactuals about Atiyah's time as governor is what would he have done, what grand plans would he have done without the recession?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So just slammed. And I don't, because he adamantly didn't have grand plans in mind.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even know who he wanted to be on his staff.
Yeah.
And so it would have been fascinating if that had not happened. Would he just have spent 8 years tinkering, making it a little bit better for business
mm-hmm.
kind of thing? Or...
Well, he would have been pushed to, I mean, every governor is,
yeah.
I think, pushed to, because you're sitting there and on the table, all these people are throwing you ideas,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
And all these different political pressures, and things are going on nationally, internationally, and you're stuck with, if you want it or not, trying to solve some of those problems.
Right.
So he would have there's no governor that doesn't have to try to deal with some of those.
Yeah.
Now, what would he have chosen? That's
yeah.
the thing.
Yeah.
If he didn't, he, just like choosing economic development later, wasn't driven by, that's what I've always wanted to do.
Exactly. I've always wanted to be a yes. salesman for the state.
Yeah.
No, it's because that's what he needed to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
The situation did yeah. that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's true in most governors, rather than them having a vision. I think that's what distinguishes McCall at times.
Mm-hmm.
He, and I've always thought it was more from his editorial background.
Yeah.
That he was used to looking around and trying to find ideas of what's going on and having an opinion about it.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever he, I know in the early 70s, he read about the case in California on Serrano,
mm-hmm.
Equal education,
mm-hmm.
and trying to then equalize between districts, everything. He just grabbed that.
Yeah.
Oh, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
That's what led eventually to him creating his school finance plan.
Yeah.
In 72 and 73.
Yeah.
So I just think his thinking did that more
right.
in his background than Atiyah was not of that character.
Yeah.
He was, okay, I'm in this business, I'm working, I'm in the legislature, I like a balanced budget, I like
mm-hmm.
To be on the revenue committee. It wasn't as if he even had ambitions, in a sense, I want to be chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. No. As far as I know,
he never went to that side. No.
No, he never went to the expenditure side.
No.
And he never then, he wanted to be the majority or minority leader.
Right.
But he didn't want to explore these other ideas within the legislature.
Yeah. It's like he figured it out within, like, maybe his first two House terms.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was in the middle, just before you got there, he was in the middle of the balloon loaf controversy on the Food and Dairy Committee, which he was chairing at that point.
I would tell you that my personal experience with Atiyah was wonderful. I thought he the way he relates to you as a person, he was always very gracious, very nice guy. I went with him. He at times would call me and say, I'm going to go up to Portland to do a couple things. If you're free, why don't you come along?
Yeah.
And I'd go along and would go up there, and he'd connect with some old friends, maybe high school friends or something that run a business, and they'd talk, and I just was there along and would go do something else. Every security officer that I dealt with in the governor's office that was there with him just enjoyed him immensely.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a genuine, nice person.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know if I've covered enough.
Well, it's if I have questions,
yes,
I'll come back.